Hi, everybody. This is Philip Drew, Administrator from the Weekend Interview Show. The following is my interview of Gene Healy, Senior Editor at the Cato Institute and author of the new study, Deployed in the USA, The Creeping Militarization on the Home Front. I've had to re-record this introduction because the intro music was way too loud. I began the interview by asking Mr. Healy, what exactly is the Posse Comitatus Law and how is it threatened? And we'll let Mr. Healy take it from there.
Sure. The Posse Comitatus Law is a 125-year-old federal statute that says essentially that soldiers are not to be used as cops. It sets out that general principle. It's also, there are certain exceptions and loopholes to it, but it enshrines what many people take to be a near constitutional principle that armed soldiers, a standing army, ought not to be used for purposes of keeping order domestically. As far as who's threatening it, there's been a lot of talk in the wake of September 11th by prominent figures such as Senator John Warner, the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and certain officials in the Bush administration, that suggest that this doctrine that peacekeeping domestically is for civilian peace officers and not for soldiers, that this doctrine may have had its day and that we ought to rely more on armed forces for keeping order on the home front, which I think would be a terrible idea.
And why do you think that would be a terrible idea?
Well, there are many different reasons, but one of the principal reasons is that soldiers and police officers have fundamentally different missions. Soldiers are trained to shoot to kill in most situations and to respond with overwhelming force, whereas domestic peace officers, ideally, are trained that they operate in an environment of constitutional rights and are required to respect the constitutional rights of the citizens they're policing. So any time in American history where we've gotten away from this principle, we've generally seen collateral damage to civilian life and liberty.
Okay, well, maybe we can go through some of that history.
Well, this principle, the Posse Comitatus Act, is only 125 years old, but certainly there's been a long, proud tradition in American history of only using soldiers to keep the peace as a last resort. That goes back to the Boston Massacre, even before independence was declared. And time and again, it follows all the way up into recent American history. And as you probably know, in order to fight the drug war, there have been some significant exceptions and weakening to the Posse Comitatus Act, and the military has gotten involved sporadically in fighting the drug war, especially close to the borders. In 1997, in Texas, actually, there was an American high school student named Ezequiel Hernandez who was shot and killed by a Marine Corps anti-drug patrol. No debate that the guy was not a criminal, but because of the training that these Marine Corps soldiers had, they reacted in a fundamentally different way than police officers are trained to, and the result was a dead American.
Right, he was a goat herder with a .22, right?
Right.
Well, and also they used the drug war loopholes in Posse Comitatus to appropriate National Guard helicopters for use against the Branch Davidians, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's another recent example of the importance of sticking to this principle. In that case, you didn't have active duty soldiers. There's some dispute, but you didn't have active duty soldiers directly involved. They were there on the scene providing equipment and advice. But in Janet Reno in her testimony said that it was Delta Force operatives who gave her the suggestion to use tanks against the Davidian dwelling, which ended so tragically.
Well, and the Dallas Morning News reported that there were at least 14 Delta Force operators at Waco on the last day, the day of the fire there.
Yeah, I know there was a lot of investigation of it. I think two of them were eventually deposed in the civil suit. But I think it goes to the point of, you've got trained military professionals. They're going to look at the situation very differently. They're going to look at it oftentimes as a combat situation, as the Delta Force operators seem to have in that particular case. And that's not where we want to go in a free democratic republic. And it would be a terrible idea to increase the chances of these incidents happening.
So the question, it really comes down to you, the difference between people being treated as suspects or enemies.
Well, there's no doubt we have foreign enemies, and likely within the country. The problem is sending, essentially militarizing American society and having a military response domestically poses great risks to, the people that happen to be standing by. And really, it's not an effective way of dealing with the threat. The military is terrific at what it does, and, none of this is to knock the military. We should be happy they're trained the way they are. But we should recognize that the way they're trained is not appropriate for domestic use. And in addition to being dangerous, it's not at all clear that greater use of the military to fight the war on terror at home would make us any safer from any al-Qaeda cells that may be operating in the country. And the military essentially is a blunt instrument. It's tremendously effective at destroying columns of enemy troops or enemy command centers. It's tremendously effective at regime change, as we saw recently. But it's a lot less effective at rooting out, shoe bombers and guys with box cutters. In this case, domestically, what you need is not a military hammer, but more of a scalpel. And the military is not well-equipped to have that kind of response.
What is NORTHCOM?
NORTHCOM is Northern Command. It's the operational center commanded by the general who is the lead commander of all forces deployed in the North American region. So there was some debate over General Ralph Eberhardt, who's made some comments himself about how we might always want to be reevaluating the doctrine of posse comitatus if we think it ties the hands of the government in protecting the American people. No, not in any important respect. There are exceptions. The fact of the matter is the Posse Comitatus Act, although it stands for an important principle, it's really a parchment barrier. There are so many exceptions. There are exceptions for good and for ill, but there are enough exceptions that there is not a significant restraint on the military doing anything that might conceivably make us safer from foreign terror attacks. For example, if there already are exceptions on the books that would come into play if, say, there was a chemical weapons attack on a New York City subway and civilian authorities couldn't deal with it, there already are exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act that would allow the military to step in on an emergency and temporary basis and deal with the situation.
Now, would that be the Army, or would that be the National Guard?
It could be either.
Does it matter?
It doesn't. When the National Guard is federalized, when it's operating under the command of the president of the federal government, it's essentially considered the Army for purposes of the Posse Comitatus Act. So I suppose that would be a question for General Eberhardt and a question for the people on the ground as to whether they were going to be federalized National Guardsmen or Army regulars.
Well, if the National Guard...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if the National Guardsmen retain, or if the governors retain control of the National Guardsmen, and they operate in a police function, is that against the Posse Comitatus as long as they're under the control of the governors?
No, it's not, actually. The Posse Comitatus Act, for purposes of the Posse Comitatus Act, the National Guard is not considered part of the Army if it's kept in its state, if it's wearing its state hat under the command of the state governors. So that's a significant exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, I mean, that gets you into a whole host of other questions about whether use of the National Guard in any particular situation is called for. But it's the legal question is pretty clear that would not be, that a state governor using National Guard would not be considered, even if they're used to enforce the laws, would not be considered a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act.
Something else that you wrote about in your study was about the militarization of local police, where even if we're not necessarily sending the Army along with local cops on every raid, that still our local police are becoming more and more like soldiers as it is.
Yeah, that's a regrettable fact, and it is driven in part by some changes to federal law to fight the drug war. Starting in the early 80s, the federal government made it a lot easier for the military services to give equipment and training to local law enforcement in the name of, among other things, fighting the drug war. And this, a lot of commentators have looked at and have seen that, have charged that it sort of inculcates this warrior cops mentality, where policemen increasingly see their job as, I don't want to generalize, but this is a, the charge is that, with the paramilitarization of, local law enforcement, too many policemen, begin to see their jobs as something more of a military function than a law enforcement function. And that has, you know, results like some of these no-knock drug enforcement raids that often end pretty tragically.
Quite often.
In some cases, it's understandable that there's a more... That local law enforcement may need a sort of higher caliber response to various events than, the simple cop on the beat with a handgun. The danger is, though, in too much bleeding in this function where, you know, a paramilitarized SWAT team approach becomes the default approach rather than something that's used in extraordinary circumstances.
Which seems to be the way it's going. I mean, SWAT was first invented, in the mid-80s in L.A., right? And now every county sheriff's department in America has one, basically.
Yeah, there's a guy named Peter Kraska, who's a criminologist, who's looked at this. And, most towns over 50,000 apparently have SWAT teams. And, it's hard to imagine that's needed in every small town in America.
Okay, well, you know, Tommy Franks brought up something in Cigar Aficionado, I guess a month or two ago, about how if there's another September 11th-like attack in this country, or, in fact, he might have been more specific. I think he might have been referring to an attack with germs or chemical weapons or a dirty bomb or something like that. and that if that happened, that we could very likely see the Constitution unravel and America turn into a military state. And I don't know whether he said that just as a trial balloon, or, you know, whether he was just kind of off the top of his head making some remarks. But I wonder, what do you think would happen if there were another September 11th attack? What would be, or what do you suppose would be the national government's response? Would Posse Comitatus go right out the window with another one of these attacks?
Well, I thought it was funny that General Franks did that in Cigar Aficionado. It seemed like kind of an odd place for that kind of speculation. So my guess is he was talking off the top of his head. It's hard to say. I mean, you'd like to think that we're not going to see significant restrictions on civil liberties. But the fact that a guy is highly placed, or once as highly placed as Tommy Franks, has speculated about it, suggests that, you know, people are thinking along these lines. What I know about chemical and biological weapons, which is, only what I've read, I have no special expertise, is that it's very hard to pull off a mass casualty attack with chemical and biological weapons. I mean, that's their legacy in use, particularly in terrorist use. I mean, you had the sarin gas attacks a few years back by that strange Aum Shinrinko cult in Japan in the Tokyo subways, which only killed about a dozen people. So I think that the threat of chemical and biological weapons, at least with what the bad guys are currently able to do with them, is a little bit overblown. And so the idea of a mass casualty event coming about through something like that seems a little far-fetched to me, given what I know about it. But that said, I think another danger, rather than the sort of nightmare scenario that General Franks depicted, is a much slower erosion of some of the things that make this country unique. I mean, not an immediate scrapping of the Constitution, but more a process that takes place as people get more and more used to the idea that there's no real difference between soldiers and cops, and it's nice and it's comforting to see armed troops in the street. And, you know, after another 10, 15 years of orange alerts, the thing you worry about is that a lot of what makes this country unique gets thrown by the wayside, and people become acclimated to the idea of the United States as the type of a place where armed soldiers on the streets are just a normal part of everyday life. And I think that would have, you know, significant effects on democratic culture, and those effects would largely be bad. So everyone worries about the kind of thing that General Franks talks about, but I also worry about a more slow accreting process of that sort of thing happening.
Yeah, kind of the frog in the pot of hot water.
Yeah, the boiling frog.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity to name the people who are pushing for revising Posse Comitatus, at least. Paul Wolfowitz and Joe Biden, you mentioned in...
Yeah, I haven't heard much from either of them in the press lately along those lines. And in fact, Wolfowitz, to his credit, early on, one thing I talk about in the paper, you may have seen, Norm Mineta, you know, transportation secretary, wanted to use Delta Force soldiers on, transcontinental flights, which is just a really stupid idea. I mean, you want Delta Force soldiers out there hunting Osama bin Laden. These are highly trained, highly motivated super soldiers, and you don't want them like collecting frequent flyer miles. So Wolfowitz, at least, although he has explored the, he has, you know, floated this idea, he at least seems to recognize that the military is not a panacea to every security problem that, that we might have. Some of the other people, like I said, General Eberhardt has floated the idea once or twice that we might want to loosen this thing and undermine Posse Comitatus. Senator Warner seems frequently to have a bee in his bonnet about it. He's talked about holding hearings at the Senate Armed Services Committee. But and more generally, I think there's just a background notion that you can kind of understand, because you know, you look at the Homeland Security bureaucracy, and they've come up with orange alerts and you know, duct tape, and you look at the professionalism of the military. A lot of people sort of have this unsophisticated idea that, well, you know, the military can surely do better than the civilians at home. So I think a lot of people have this idea. And the point of the paper is really to say, to take a step back and say, look, there are important reasons why we have this tradition in American society, and why we should never, why we should maintain the idea that the military is not a first responder. It's a last resort.
Excellent. Everybody, you listened to an interview of Gene Healy. He's a senior editor at the Cato Institute and author of Deployed in the USA, The Creeping Militarization on the Home Front, on Radio Chaos 95.9. Right before I let you go, sir, I want to give you a chance to bash Woodrow Wilson. I'd like to give this chance to everyone who I have on the show. And I noticed that in your study you talk quite a bit about what happened during World War I when the military was unleashed on the American people and the incredible consequences. I thought I knew everything I needed to know about why to hate Woodrow Wilson, but you added a whole another chapter to my book
well,
that I have going on in my head. So why don't you refresh us a little bit about what was going on during World War I here at home?
Well, you know, a lot of us have worried in the current environment about restrictions on civil liberty as a result of the war on terror. But not to minimize a lot of the abuses that have happened, but compared to the stuff that went on in World War I, we've really seen nothing yet. Wilson did set the Military Intelligence Division of the Army loose at home during World War I. And if you remember I'm sure you remember the controversy over Operation Tips, you know, the idea to get a legion of citizen informants together and to spy on their neighbors.
Sure, well, that's the one they renamed Operation Talon, right?
Talon, is that what they did?
They renamed it.
Well, in the Wilson administration, there was something called the American Protective League, which was a legion of sort of self-styled patriots, mostly guys that were too old for military service, and they were sort of deputized by the Justice Department and used on occasion by the military to do a lot of domestic surveillance. And the initial idea was we're going to go out and capture German spies and, you know, figure out who's part of the espionage network within the United States. But what ended up happening was, you know, they went to union meetings and draft rallies and spied on their fellow citizens, in some cases had arrest authority, acted like junior G-men. And, you know, and this is just one of the many abuses that came about during World War I. And when you go back and look at it, it's pretty astounding.
Well, and I think you said in your paper there that millions of people were harassed, and, you know, to one degree or another, and that in the end, all they found was one German saboteur.
Right.
After turning the whole country upside down, arresting people for talking bad about Wilson at their own dinner table.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, when you look back at what happened in World War One, it's kind of a hard thing to think that there has been this much of a pushback from the American public on certain things that have been proposed in the War on Terror, like total information awareness.
Right. Well, I'd like to thank you for pushing back for your part, Mr. Healy.
Well, thanks, and thanks a lot for having me on.
Sure thing. Everybody, Gene Healy is senior editor at the Cato Institute and author of Deployed in the USA, The Creeping Militarization on the Home Front. Thank you so much for coming on the air today, sir.
Thanks again.